Hello, folks. You're listening to CITR 101.9 FM, coming to you from traditional unceded Musqueam territory here at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver, BC, Canada. Normally, I would be starting my regular radio show, Dunkin's Donuts, here, but this week I'm going to showcase some of the audio stories created for LFS 400, which is a course I co-teach here at UBC. It's a podcasting course. So fourth-year students, be it from the faculty that I work for, Land and Food Systems, or around the campus, have the term to create podcasts, basically, 10 to 12 minute stories. And they're really, I'm really proud of those students. And I wanted to take this hour to showcase some of those. So instead of regular Dunkin' Donuts, we'll be playing these over the course of the next hour. And if you like what you hear, you can hear more of them at lfs400.landfood.ubc.ca. And don't worry, I will be back next week with a regular episode of Dunkin' Donuts and previewing Music Waste. Big thanks to Dora Duber, the volunteer manager here, for filling in last week and creating Dora's Danishes. Yes. We're about to hear a song just to start us off by Housewind. Housewind is a new project by Matthew Budden of Shrouded Amps. He's going to be releasing this cassette called Locusts Make Honey this Saturday night at the Toast Collective. So if you like what you hear, check out Housewind. They'll be playing with Survivalism, What, and Bach this Saturday night at the Toast. And stay tuned for five excellent stories by UBC students about issues around land and food and nutrition. All right. See you next week.
Hey, this is John Mouse, and you're listening to Dunkin's Donuts.
That was the wrong episode. Sorry. One sec. Here we go. Okay. Just while I'm getting this ready, let's see here. Let's see. That's more like it. I'd love to hear Lizzo again, but let's listen to this instead. This is stories from LFS 400.
It's 4 a.m., June 22nd, 2014. My race starts in 3.5 hours. It's the Scotiabank Half Marathon, 21.1 kilometers from the University of British Columbia to Stanley Park. I've taken my insulin and just finished breakfast. The insulin should be gone by the start of the race. I won't have to worry about my blood sugars going low. This is part of my racing strategy. I've trained all season for this race. I've conquered other races in preparation for this race. I'm ready.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
The run's going great. At 10 kilometers in, I look at my Garmin. It says my pace is faster than it's ever been at this point. But just 1 kilometer later, it all falls apart. My pace slows to a turtle's crawl. I'm starting to feel nauseous. I slow down to check my blood sugars. They're 14.8. They should be under 7. Are you freaking kidding me? F you, diabetes. That's when my race ended. Welcome to Diabetic to Dietetics, a podcast all about sport and type 1 diabetes. I'm Katie Bartel. I'm a long-distance runner, and I have type 1 diabetes. This is my journey. Type 1 diabetes is an autoimmune disease that shuts down the pancreas. We produce little to no insulin and require synthetic insulin to survive, either by injection or insulin pump therapy. Nutrition and exercise are also key to staying healthy with type 1. In this podcast, I'm going to introduce you to other athletes with type 1 diabetes. We're going to describe the challenges and frustrations of being an athlete with this disease, both in sport and in healthcare.
It's frustrating because you look at all the other athletes out there and they don't have this internal battle going on where you have to manage your insulin dosage levels and test your blood sugar levels and sort of like keep track of all these different variables while also trying to push your body to its maximum capacity in your race. And you just get frustrated because they don't have these struggles and they don't have those bad days that you do.
That was Jamie Hennessy. Jamie is a superstar track athlete with the UBC Thunderbirds. Her events include the 1500 meters, 800 meter, 3 kilometer steeplechase, and the 8 kilometer cross country distances. She trains 6 days a week, averaging 75 minutes per run, plus cross training and a full-time school schedule. And she does all that with type 1 diabetes. Jamie uses an insulin pump, a small device that acts like a pancreas would. Most days she loves the flexibility her pump provides. But when she's racing, she always reverts back to old school needles.
I've had problems in the past where my pump has failed me on race day, and that has been a total disaster. My pancreas doesn't function. It can't combat that itself, so I have to manually inject extra insulin to cover that.
Like Jamie, Stephanie Hendy has also had problems with her pump in competition. Stephanie races obstacle courses where she runs through mud, weaves under barbed wire, and climbs steep walls, among other things. As Stephanie has discovered, insulin pumps and mud do not mix.
I wear an Omnipod, and the Omnipod was stopping delivering insulin during races. And it wasn't because it was like falling off my body. It was just that the movement or the change in temperature was causing the cannula to block or occlude. Then I would get this terrible ear-piercing alarm that would cause me to rip it from my body. And then you have to stick a pin on the backside of the circuit board to get the alarm to stop. And so you're mid-race and you're thinking like, oh, no, I'm squelching. And I have to literally rip this thing off my body, and you might be covered in mud, and so it's not really all that sanitary.
Being active with type 1 diabetes is like living on a tightrope, constantly struggling to balance insulin doses with nutrient intake with activity. If our blood sugars go low, we suffer dizziness, confusion, muscle fatigue. Sometimes we even pass out. In runner speak, it's like hitting the wall to the extreme. If our blood sugars go high, we suffer nausea and cramping, or worse, end up in the hospital with dangerously toxic blood levels. As Stephanie describes, type 1 is not a predictable disease.
I would often start a race, say at 15 or 16 millimoles per liter, and then I would race 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 hours and still be 17 after. How do you dose when you're mid-race? You're like, well, I'm moving, I'm exercising, but my blood sugar is also 16, so how much do I need? And I need to keep eating, otherwise I don't get any glycogen replenishment when you're going through it. There's a lot of variables to consider.
For most of us, trial and error or talking with other like-minded type 1s has been our go-to mechanisms for figuring out this disease with our respective sports. As it stands, there's little to no resources for this population in healthcare. It can be rewarding when we succeed and extremely frustrating when we fail. That's one of the reasons why Stephanie pursued a career as an exercise physiologist.
I realized there's nobody here to help me with what I want to do, so I'm just going to have to learn it myself and do it myself. And I wanted to be there for other people who were going through similar struggles. I knew I couldn't possibly be the only one that's feeling ignored.
So, why aren't there resources? I sought the answer to this from Dr. Dale Clayton, an endocrinologist who's also a CrossFit athlete and has type 1 diabetes. Dr. Clayton is not just a talking head. He's not an outdated textbook either. He's living this experience. I had to talk to him.
Hi.
Hi. Are you ready to
do? I am.
Thanks. Straight up, I asked Dr. Clayton about resources.
It's definitely an underrepresented or recognized, I think, population, because if you are young and healthy with type 1 diabetes, you're not a major healthcare resource user. It's not like you're showing up in the hospital all the time. That's where the type 2 world certainly has way more attention focused to it, and that's not necessarily a bad thing, but it's the type 1 world has definitely been left to their own devices because the emphasis has just not been there. Fewer numbers of patients relative to the type 2 world, and not with other comorbidities happening at the same time.
There are over 2 million individuals living with type 1 diabetes in North America, 300,000 in Canada. Nearly every sport has type 1 representation. NHL hockey player Max Domi, Olympic rower Chris Jarvis, NFL football player Mark Andrews, elite cyclist Becky Ferrada. This is a growing population, and rightfully so.
The benefits are very clear because exercise has such a direct effect, specifically in the context of type 1 diabetes, on insulin sensitivity. So it allows you to, in essence, keep blood sugars controlled with less insulin. Not no insulin, you absolutely still have to have insulin, but you don't need as much. And given that you can use your muscles to take up blood sugar without the need for insulin, it reduces the amount of variability that you might experience if you don't need to be giving such big doses of insulin at a single go.
The benefits are a great motivator, yes, but without supports, it can be a real struggle. Temperature, anxiety, excitement, illness, hormones, sleep, the type of activity, the status of your blood sugars the night before, all of these things can affect your diabetes management in sport.
One of the main challenges, I think, with managing diabetes, specifically with exercise, is you need to be resilient. You need to learn from your experiences. You need to not beat yourself up when it doesn't work. You need to try and try again. It's a lot of trial and error and figuring out what works.
Honestly, that's not good enough. This population is forced to persevere predominantly on their own in spite of their disease. When I dropped out of the Scotiabank Half in 2014, I felt alone. I felt there was nobody that could understand my challenge. I now know that's not true. There's a huge community of us fighting through these challenges in order to reap the benefits of a life in sport. Jamie Hennessy, our track athlete, wouldn't have it any other way.
I love racing. I love, like, pushing my body to its max limits, and I have never really ever considered quitting because diabetes is annoying and frustrating. It doesn't matter for me. I will, like, take the challenge and try and do my best to work with diabetes instead of against it.
For Stephanie Hendy, no matter how difficult the challenges may be, not being active is not an option.
Because the weight of the condition is so intense. If I don't have something to strive for, to improve upon, then I think I'd be a lot more of an unhappy person. Even with all of the additional level of complications that exercise brings, I'm so much happier. I'm so much less anxious. I have other things to talk about.
I recently went back to Jericho Beach to revisit that failed Scotiabank moment. Sitting on a log that looked pretty darn close to the one I sat on back then, the feelings I had came back so vividly.
I was sitting here frustrated and angry and sad and embarrassed and ashamed. I remember the tears. I was crying, watching all these runners pass me by, and I was sitting here on this log and I couldn't do anything about it. To be taken out by diabetes, something that I never thought would happen, I was pissed off.
I never wanted to feel that way again. I didn't want others to either. 5 years ago, I was still a working journalist. Today, I'm approaching my last year of the dietetics major at UBC. My goal is to fill a gap in the healthcare system. I'm going to be a dietitian who can help Jamie, Stephanie, and even Dr. Dale Clayton. I'm going to be a dietitian specifically for athletes with type 1 diabetes.
Welcome to Your Gut Has Gone Mental podcast. How much do you know about probiotics?
Isn't it just if you're, like, adding more, like, better bacteria.
All I know about probiotics is that I see them a lot in the Activia commercials. I know that it helps with digestion and with your gut flora. I know something like that. And I know that people make a big deal out of them. They make it seem like if you have probiotics, you're healthy. And I don't know if that's true or not.
They help improve your gut biome. They help promote healthy digestion. That's pretty much it.
I don't know anything about probiotics. It's something people talk about when they're talking about being healthy, and like it's something your doctor would mention.
It's good if you just took antibiotics because it replenishes gut bacteria. Otherwise, I don't know how much I believe in it.
Probiotics are live bacteria that can be taken as supplements or found in foods. We usually think of bacteria as germs that cause diseases, but the human body contains 10 times more bacteria than human cells. While bacteria most familiar to us are harmful, such as E. coli or Salmonella, many are in fact incredibly beneficial. Recently, probiotics have been all the buzz, with new studies suggesting gut bacteria can affect mental health. As a UBC student, brain health is extremely important to me. If a probiotic has the potential to help improve my mood and mental clarity, this could be life-changing.
And I think in some cases there's compelling data. For example, if you take an anxious, a stressed, or depressed mouse or rat to fecal transfer normal mouse or rat, you will transfer that phenotype of the anxious, stressed, or depressed just by transferring the poop, basically. That's pretty strong evidence. There's strong evidence in people that basically it's directly proportional to the courses of antibiotics you take. The more antibiotics you take, the higher your levels of anxiety and stress and depression associated with it. And what do antibiotics do? They kill microbes.
That was Dr. Brett Finlay, a microbiologist and author well known for his contributions to understanding the role of microbiota in human health and disease. With research supporting that the gut and brain are linked, what are the underlying mechanisms behind this?
What we now believe in the last 5 years or so is that it's a two-way communication. And there's signals being sent from the gut to the brain. And of course, if you're talking about signals coming from the gut, you have to think about microbes, right? So microbes do make neurotransmitters, and they affect the immune system, which affects how the vagus nerve works. And they have all these different effects on sending signals up to the brain.
This kind of concept of the gut as like the second brain, your gut is really heavily innervated. So we normally talk about like your sympathetic and parasympathetic nervous system, but we forget oftentimes about the enteric nervous system, which actually has more nerve cells than your spinal cord. And there's a huge amount of information coming between the gut and the brain. And like 90% of that dialogue is coming from the gut on up to the brain.
According to dietitian, author, and gut health expert Desiree Nielsen, the gut is, in fact, a much more complex system than once believed. It plays a huge role in our emotions and mental health.
We do know that gut bacteria and alterations in gut health are associated with depression, with anxiety, maybe even in subsets of kids with autism. And we see in the research that there is the potential for probiotics to help improve symptoms of depression and anxiety. Most of the serotonin in our body is not made in our brain, it's made in our gut. Also, we know that there is a certain amount of inflammation involved in depression, so it is really an inflammatory disorder, just as much as it is a disorder of serotonin. Bacteria can alter serotonin production, but it can definitely change inflammatory status.
The mind-gut connection may be the gateway to how probiotics might help us treat depression, anxiety, and other mental illnesses. But determining how to choose a probiotic or whether or not they're working is an issue.
So with probiotics now, it's kind of like you say, okay, you need a new pair of runners. You walk into a sports goods store. You got waffles of joggers and walkers and court shoes and bike shoes and hiking shoes. And you don't just grab a pair and say, okay, I got a pair of runners. I'm out of here, right? You have a specific need. And I think that's the problem with probiotics. Everyone just you know, it's bewildering when you go into a store how many there are.
The challenge is there's a really big gulf between what we see in the research and what's actually available for people to buy on the store shelves. So it's still a pretty controversial thing.
The problem with probiotics is that you don't have to be regulated like FDA drugs. You don't have to prove in a clinical trial they work or not. You just have to be safe. And so people make these probiotic claims. They don't have to back them up with data. When they go to the gut's a very different world than those places we're talking about. And it's kind of like parachuting a penguin in the desert. It's not going to live, right? So that's why you have to take such high numbers, like 10 billion microbes every day, because they don't stick. They go right through.
Another barrier for many is knowing when we need probiotics.
If you feel really good, you don't have any issues with like mental health or digestive health or inflammation, and you eat a really good diet, and for gut bacteria, that means a super high fiber diet, which will encourage the growth of gut bacteria, you might be okay without a probiotic at this point.
Modern day probiotics aren't quite there yet when it comes to treating mental illnesses. The future, however, is very promising.
I think in the future we're going to get smart probiotics. They're microbes from the gut, for the gut, or from the skin, for the skin. They're going to have a defined chemical function that we know we need to fix something. And there'll probably be a mixture of microbes. You know, one microbe will not do it all kind of thing. So I'm very optimistic that next-gen probiotics, or probiotics 2.0, whatever you want to call it, there'll be some really smart ones out there.
We don't have any probiotics that can claim they improve depression or anxiety, but in the research, we see that the potential is totally there.
At this point, simply taking a probiotic may not be the fix-all solution to a healthy gut. So what else can we do to improve our gut health?
The connection between diet and microbiome is still a pretty young science, but what appears pretty clear is A, that good microbes want you to eat a ton of fiber. And when you think about it, like, you're digesting like 80 to 95% of everything you eat and drink. Most of your gut bacteria live in your colon. So if you need to feed them, you need to feed them something that you don't digest and absorb. And that's generally fiber.
On a good day, the average Canadian male might, you're supposed to eat 35 grams, which seems like a lot for a diet. Most people don't even anywhere near that. White sugar, white flour, processed foods. And what that does is it selects basically for bad microbes. Because these are already digested, broken down, simple sugars, you absorb them very early in the small intestine. You suck them out there, yet most of the microbes are way down in the large intestine, and the nutrients never get there.
Evidence and research shows that our diet plays a very important role in our gut health. The challenge is figuring out to what extent our diet impacts our gut health.
And then the other thing that seems fairly certain at this point is more the literature on like dietary pattern. So, I mean, no surprise, our typical North American, like hyper-processed, super high fat, super high sugar, not much fiber, not much actual real food, is pretty detrimental to beneficial bacteria.
It is possible that our guts are less resilient and oversensitive. This could be linked to the higher levels of depression and anxiety in today's modern world.
Foraging societies have and stuff, there's huge differences. And bottom line is, we don't have very healthy microbes anymore. And the other concern is that each generation, we're getting less and less diverse in our microbes, and we're getting more and more similar as we all live in cities and have the same foods and things.
So there is a huge change. It's not our genetics that have changed that fast. It is our lifestyle. So the hygiene hypothesis states that as we get cleaner, as we eat this food that's created in sterile environments, where, you know, we're not sitting there digging in the dirt or with animals that might actually expose us to these microbes, that our immune system is not getting the proper education, and it's becoming hyperactive. And when you consider that most of our immunity is in the gut, that has huge implications for gut health.
It's difficult to determine what exact factors may be impacting our gut health. But it's certain that keeping a healthy lifestyle is a step in the right direction.
To just give a probiotic, or just do a couple of dietary interventions, or just give a medication isn't how we fix them. You know, it's not this idea of just like slapping on a medication to get rid of the symptom. We really need to be addressing like the whole system, like the whole body, not just the gut.
So can probiotics really benefit brain health? With the promising research, there's definite potential. However, as Desiree and Brett explained, what's out there right now is not quite there yet. So before spending a whole bunch of money on probiotics, consider lifestyle changes and your diet. Brain health is so complex, it's challenging to pinpoint cause and effect of depression and anxiety. But there are ways to manage and improve your mental health, and it's clear that supporting your gut flora is one of them. A huge thank you to Brett Finlay and Desiree Nielsen for taking the time to speak with me. This podcast couldn't have happened without them. To find out more about gut health, look for Brett's new book, The Whole Body Microbiome, which explores our mini universe within. Also, tune into The Urban Vegetarian on Gusto TV, hosted by Desiree. Thanks so much for listening.
One day in my second year of chemistry, I was taking a break and some downtime with my instructor and lab partner, which was quite rare. We were talking about music. The instructor asked us if we pay for music. My lab partner answered, saying, "Why would I pay when I could just get it for free?" And I thought to myself a little bit and said, "Why would I pay for songs? If I wanted to buy like 10 songs, that would be like 3 days worth of food for me." And when I said that, I just remember their faces looking at me as if something was clearly not okay and that they were quite concerned. I remember feeling bad and just having to reassure them that I'm okay and I do manage, even though I barely do. But that was that.
What this student is experiencing is food insecurity, not having or worrying about not having enough money to buy food that is nutritious, safe, and acceptable for you. In Canada, Proof reports that about 12% of Canadian households experience some form of food insecurity. At Canadian universities, the story is different. Meal Exchange, a nonprofit that supports students in running programs that improve their campus food systems, explored the subject at 5 universities across Canada. They report that about 40% of students experience food insecurity. That's 40%. 2 out of 5 students. Were you aware?
Maybe just like my general wellness is not as good as it could be. It's just like a thing in the back of your mind.
I had 3 exams in a week and I had to pick up another shift at work. It was really stressful for me, sacrificing my studying time.
Proof reports that people experiencing food insecurity are 2 times more likely to experience anxiety and other mood disorders. And according to the BC Centre for Disease Control, in the long term, they can experience depression and chronic conditions such as cardiovascular disease. So what supports are available for students facing food insecurity at UBC?
Hi, so my name is Simran and I'm the food bank coordinator for the AMS Food Bank, and I've been so for the last 10 months.
The AMS Food Bank is located in the basement of the Student Life building. When you walk in, it's no bigger than a small living room. There are metal racks, a welcome desk on your left-hand side. Murals created by student artists brighten the space. 1 freezer and 1 fridge where fresh produce is scarce at the moment. There are a lot of canned goods, many canned goods. Pasta boxes and mac and cheese, and a small section with toiletries.
So we do run primarily on donations. We have a small budget that we receive from the AMS we can use to buy food, but sort of like a worst case scenario, it's our last resort. We depend a lot on donations from clubs and offices in the community.
The AMS Food Bank has been open since 2005. Since then, usage has increased dramatically.
When we started in 2005, we had 5 client visits the whole year, and then just last year in 2018, we had almost 1,000. I know that at the beginning of 2019, we were sitting at about a 13% increase from last year, so it definitely is still going up. We're always just adding and adding the number of clients we have. I don't expect that trend to change anytime soon, unfortunately.
There are people who use the food bank more often than others. Students are limited to 6 visits a semester, and some need to use all 6. The busiest times in the food bank are towards the end of the term, when loans, bursaries, and summer funds are running low.
So visiting a food bank on a busy day, it could look like a lineup out the door, and then it can be kind of congested. The food bank is not too big. I'd say there's enough comfortably in the room for 4 to 5 people. So on days where we are experiencing lines and having multiple people come at once, It can start feeling a bit stuffy. People might be getting in people's ways. I'd hope that it wouldn't like deter people from using the food bank. We are quite flexible with offering individual appointments outside of regular hours so that we can really accommodate being able to have a one-on-one service if somebody fears being seen by somebody else or doesn't really want to share that experience with another client.
While food banks are important for people in immediate need for food, the stigma of using a food bank can keep people away. In fact, research by Dr. Valerie Tarasuk shows only about 20% of those who are food insecure visit food banks, in part because of the stigma associated with accessing charitable services. This means it is likely that many UBC students who are food insecure don't get the help they need due to the shame associated with using food banks. There are, however, initiatives on campus that aim at breaking the barrier of stigma to food access.
There's a lot of contention and discussions around food banks in general. And so for me, and wanting to work with the student food bank was around trying to meaningfully engage those who are hungry in our community.
Meet Dr. Tara Moreau, Associate Director at the UBC Botanical Garden.
One of my theories of change is around food skills and trying to highlight one of the best ways that we can be healthy and sort of reduce our food costs is to be cooking and to be really proactive.
She started the Harvesting Food Skills program last summer, which is partly funded by UBC Wellbeing and run in collaboration with the AMS Food Bank. People attending the program help harvest food and then come together to make an easy, nutritious meal. Participants can also take as much of the harvested food as they wish.
So I think working with the food bank and trying to empower their clients to learn about how food is grown and to get excited about growing food and learning more about it and cooking and sharing together and meeting new people, really just support people in a way that is with dignity rather than a sort of a Band-Aid approach.
And although research by Proof Canada shows that community programs like Harvesting Food Skills can have an impact on social connection and food literacy, they too have barriers. The timing of workshops can be tricky for students with full schedules. Some may just not have the time between classes, part-time jobs, and studying to dedicate 2 hours to a workshop, regardless of the benefit. While community programs may be hard to access, there is one strategy that most students would agree with: lowering the price of food on campus. I spoke to the interim vice president students, Andrew Parr, on this matter. His usual position is managing director of student housing and hospitality services, including UBC Food Services.
UBC Food Services is the primary provider of food to this campus, and it covers its cost of operations through the revenues it generates from the sales it provides. It has to sustain itself in that way, but it's looking creatively at creative ways of providing inexpensive options. We're looking at creating a food outlet that's built around affordability, so lesser expensive entree items and meal items that are also healthy, and is kind of one of the plans that are being worked on right now.
In addition to the low-cost cafe, Parr mentions that most UBC Food Services locations already offer meals for $5. And while it is great to have cheaper food options on campus, there's still an issue here. If you don't have enough money to begin with, a cheaper option is still inaccessible. Much like with community kitchens and food skills workshops, while these initiatives provide some supports to students, none of these solutions tackle the root cause of food insecurity: lack of money.
So what do you think UBC can do for their students?
Well, I do think there's an interesting, you know, a big momentum more at the local government and provincial and national level is thinking about poverty reduction strategies. And I definitely think of that as a student, you know, are we setting up our students for success? I think there's ways that we can ensure that the students that we're bringing in have a plan for how they're going to survive. And I think budgeting is not something that you learn overnight. So I think there's ways that we can be supporting students so that they can be more equipped to manage their own budget.
Granted, there is some personal responsibility. And while budgeting is one strategy, research at Acadia University and the University of Alberta shows that students who are food insecure already use budgeting as a strategy. The issue at hand is that of insufficient funding. Students, like most people who are food insecure, are part of the workforce. They have bursaries, loans, part-time jobs on top of their course load, and sometimes that's still not enough. So, Dan, what is UBC doing about it?
I should say there is one other thing that the university is doing that's not directly related to sort of the delivery of food, but it's around student financial aid. You know, there's every year the university looks at ways of putting more into student financial aid programming. So I think that'll continue to be looked at.
I would say up until the last few months, food insecurity was probably not noted or mentioned in a, say, at the exec table or the board table. On an annual basis, the university reviews tuitions and goes through a tuition consultation process. This year, the board looked at it in terms of what is the impact it has on students in terms of the overall cost of education. And out of that came some conversations about food insecurity. There's no disputing that this is an issue and it has a really significant impact on students in terms of their mental and physical well-being, and things need to be done. And that's about where we're at. To be perfectly honest, you know, I think what's to be done at an institutional level hasn't yet been determined, and we need to have that conversation, you know, relatively quickly and move to a place where we start taking some more significant action than we currently are.
Long overdue conversations are happening. And while student food insecurity is on the radar, we must keep it that way and turn thoughts into actions. Currently, UBC is exploring the scope of food insecurity on campus. The Undergraduate Experience Survey now has questions that directly ask students about food insecurity. However, the survey misses graduate students, who are the majority of AMS food bank users. And while there are many current initiatives that benefit students, there needs to be a distinction between initiatives that support overall well-being and those that specifically tackle student food insecurity at the root cause. Needless to say, this is a complex problem, and it's going to take all hands on deck, including ours as students. If we care about our future and for the future of students yet to come, we need to take a stand. A stand for equitable opportunities that do not sacrifice our education and health while at university and in the future. We need to keep the university accountable and together lobby for improved economic conditions to make education accessible to all. It will be a long road to end food insecurity on campus, but we must start now.
It is Saturday morning, and I'm grocery shopping. I enter the supermarket and grab a loaf of bread. And as I put it in my basket, a shiny gold label catches my eye. I look at the label. It says GMO-free in big letters. All of a sudden, my hunger is replaced with confusion. This is completely new for me. GMO stands for genetically modified organism, and GMO-free means that none of the ingredients used in the product are genetically modified. The GMO-free labels are seen as something positive, but the labels do not explain why it is supposedly good to eat food that is GMO-free. We just assume it. But is this really the case? My name is Wessel, and I study biotechnology in the Netherlands. During my study, I have genetically engineered countless bacteria and plants, but I never stood still and thought what other people might think of this. So when I came to Canada and saw these GMO-free stickers for the first time, I started to wonder why GMOs are often seen as a bad thing, and why we use GMOs in the first place. So to answer these questions, I first tried to find an expert who could tell me what a GMO is.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. Nice to meet you.
Yeah.
That is Dr. Vivian Meeste, and she's an associate professor at the Wine and Research Center of the University of British Columbia. She's a yeast biologist and has worked with GMOs in the past, and she even taught a course about GMOs. So I asked her if she could explain to me what a GMO is.
Genetically modified organisms are any organism where foreign DNA, meaning DNA from another species, has been inserted into its genome. And usually this would be done in the lab, because actually this does happen in nature as well. But GMOs would be a specific modification done in a lab on purpose to make the organism have a new feature that's useful for agricultural production or food production.
So we now know what a GMO is. But the next question is, why we make GMOs in the first place?
There's a few different reasons. Initially, it was based on trying to improve or find ways to improve agriculture. So, for example, the first GMOs that were made were to try to make plants resistant to certain types of agricultural pests that might eat crops. And so those ones, they expressed a toxin that would actually kill like whatever would eat the crop, so the crop would be more likely to survive, and that would reduce the need to actually have to add pesticides.
Most genetically engineered crops that we see today are focused on production characteristics. So many of the crops either have enhanced insect resistance or they have herbicide resistance to tolerate herbicides when they are sprayed to control the other weeds. Now that we know what GMOs are and why we make them, it is time to look at the controversies surrounding GMOs. To find out both sides of the story, I spoke with two experts, one opposed and one who supports it.
Hello, hello.
This is Eric Derriere. He works for Greenpeace as a senior global strategist on food systems and ecological agriculture, and this is his opinion on GMOs.
You know, GMOs is a very specific limitation. The last 25 years, it's been the same thing, you know, herbicide tolerant and producing a pesticide. I mean, this is basically the only thing it has produced so far. So imagine if all the money spent on that kind of research, you know, had been gone into ecological farming, how to grow, food in a way which is more ecological, and funding organic farming and so forth, I think would have been a better way now. I think we've wasted 25 years, basically. We could have done things much better.
Russell?
Yeah. Hi.
Andrew.
Russell, nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you.
This is Dr. Andrew Reisman. He's an associate professor in the Faculty of Land and Food Systems at the University of British Columbia. He studies plant breeding and genetics and sustainable production systems, and this is his opinion on GMOs.
I love the technology because I think it can save a lot of time over traditional plant breeding. You know, yeah. As a plant breeder, I accept it's going to take 10 to 15 years before I see my end product. Depending on the genetic engineering system and the trait, it could happen in 2 years.
So here we have two experts with two very different opinions on GMOs. And when you talk about GMOs, there's one company that is notorious for using them, Monsanto. Monsanto is a company that produces genetically modified seeds, and they have appeared in the news numerous times and are generally seen as a bad company. So I wondered if Eric and Andrew could tell me more about this infamous company.
I mean, Monsanto is just one of those big chemical companies created in the 1920s. They were looking at chemical products. They went to agriculture, and therefore their business plan is to sell more and more pesticides and herbicides, right? So those companies and this kind of techniques in agriculture, I think especially if we want to move towards more ecological farming, those companies do not have a space in the future. And they change radically, but I don't see them changing radically, right? They make money out of pesticide, and So I think that's also another element for credibility. You know, it's not so much GMOs or biotech per se. It's also who are the main economic actors behind it, and that they're going to develop product that sells their product, not necessarily do good for the environment or help farmers or feed more people or respond to humanity's challenge around the future of this planet, right?
You know, I think Monsanto is a very impressive company. I've never worked for them. I've never bought their products. I have no affiliation with them. So this is a third-party opinion. Oftentimes, Monsanto is held up as the devil, the root cause of all of our problems in the food system. And I think that's unfair. I think that if you think of Monsanto as a company, they're behaving exactly as any large company should. They're looking out for their shareholders. They are acquiring technologies. They are acquiring and developing products that are very popular. I think that, you know, when you swim with sharks, you should expect to be bitten. Don't expect a shark to behave like a guppy. Why would you expect Monsanto to behave any differently than who they are? A big company looking out for their shareholders. I think Monsanto has gotten a bad rap. When they first released their first transgenic material, a lot of the criticism was around, well, how do you control it from pollen escape? And now it's a legitimate concern. So to address that issue, Monsanto bought a company in, I think it was Massachusetts, that developed what's now come to be known as Terminator technology. And what it does is it prevents a seed from germinating. So they bought this technology to control their pollen, and then they get slammed because of an unintended application could be that farmers don't save seed anymore. But if farmers are using hybrid seed, they buy seed each year anyhow. They don't save seed. So they got slammed in the press. They got slammed in public opinion for what I think they're trying to do the right thing.
Again, we see two completely different sides of the story, showing how controversial GMOs really are. So my next and final question to Eric and Andrew was, what kind of future do you see for GMOs?
Yeah, I think the world should turn the page and then on the herbicide tolerant and pesticide, you know. I think the growth of organic food in the world, it's incredible, you know, despite all the pressure. I think there's a shift happening very fast. People realize we just have to produce differently. We cannot continue anymore. There's a climate change crisis coming to us, so we have less and less time. So people want to do it, to do the right thing, personally. So it's why more people buy organic food. But also, you know, I think the politicians should line up. Fortunately, they're not there yet. But I think it's up to us to collectively to put pressure on them and then to shift towards more ecological food, more healthier food.
I think they will be used in conjunction with every other tool at food producers' disposal to achieve maximum production with minimum environmental impact. And I also think that it would allow for a faster development of new crops in response to climate change. I think the rate of climate change is going to be so quick that conventional breeders will not be able to keep up with what farmers need in time. So I think genetic engineering can shorten that time span as well.
After listening to both sides of the story, I have come to the conclusion about what I think of GMOs. I must agree with Eric on that big companies have been too focused on quantity over quality. However, as Eric does not see a future for GMOs, I do. I agree with Andrew that GMOs are going to be needed in the future to be able to sustain ourselves. With our rising population and pressing climate change disasters on the horizon, I see GMOs as a tool that can be used to maybe solve these issues one day. Finally, there's one line that Andrew said that really resonates well with my view on GMOs.
I consider genetic engineering a simple tool for plant breeders to use, and plant breeders have lots of other tools. So it's up to the individual to say what tool best fits my goal. And sometimes genetic engineering is the answer, and other times it's not. So I don't see it as genetic engineering or nothing. I don't see it black and white. I see it as a continuum, and that we need to use every tool at our disposal because things are really pressing.
I guess it's based on our culture. We always use Chinese medicine to maintain our health condition. So more or less, Chinese people, we believe in Chinese medicine because my parents taught me like what is good, that's why we keep using it. Just a family tradition.
Growing up, my family frequently used traditional Chinese medicine, also known as TCM. Even though my grandfather was a surgeon and my grandmother was a nurse in Hong Kong, they still use TCM and have always pushed me to use it too. My mom, who you heard earlier, learned TCM through generations of shared knowledge. And this puts me in a tight spot, since I don't plan on continuing this tradition and passing down the knowledge. Yeah, I did use TCM when I was younger, mostly drinking herbal soups that my mom prepared, but later stopped using it. And to be honest, I never really believed in it and was always concerned about the lack of scientific evidence. Recently, though, TCM has been growing in popularity, not only in the Asian population, but also in the Western population as well. I had an appointment at a TCM clinic last week, and I was actually the only Chinese patient in the reception. And this has made me question it even more. Was I wrong to doubt it, or was there something I overlooked? Do I need to reevaluate my concerns and criticisms of TCM? To answer these questions, I turned to the National Traditional Chinese Medicine Association of Canada. I met with Dr. Martin Kwok, a TCM practitioner at Richmond Alternative Medical Clinic, to talk about his work. We began the conversation discussing the foundations on which traditional Chinese medicine is based.
So Chinese medicine, then it goes back into the yin and yang philosophy, the five elements. So everything that's yin and yang, right? There's a day and there's night. There's good and there's bad. A disease, a condition, you can consider it's a yin type of condition or yang type of condition. For example, if somebody has a fever, so when you think about, so what are you going to do? How do you bring that heat, that fire down? So one thing is, yes, you could put something cooling. So you find herbs that's what we consider cooling in nature. The five elements, then it goes into the organs. Different organ is actually designated an element in traditional Chinese medicine. For example, there's the heart is fire. Your kidney is, they consider water. So there needs to be a balance between water and fire. And a certain element support the other element. For example, you know, wood will support your fire. So basically, there's that different characteristics.
Why hasn't there been scientific evidence found to support TCM?
Partly, again, it's this current Western model try to use that to explain Chinese medicine. It doesn't exactly fit that traditional Chinese practice model. One is, you know, in the Western model is what we call microscopic point of view. Everything they try to get to the smallest element, smallest molecules, you know, maybe the smallest function of your body. But in Chinese medicine is they try to use more macro volume.
Dr. Kwok explained that it is much easier to research and find evidence in Western medicine because they study isolated systems or molecules. It's harder in TCM, where they have to study the effects on multiple systems or even the entire body, and because TCM remedies can hold many ingredients.
Whatever you think is scientific knowledge needs to be proven by time. As they say, how many science 20, 30 years ago has been overturned? Traditional Chinese medicine is more what we call empirical knowledge. It's been practiced over hundreds, thousands of years. So it's proven by generations. But in terms of if you want to use current scientific eyes to examine it, it's fine. But you have to know what parameter or how do you do that. You can't totally use the Western way. As I said, when people say there's not enough so-called scientific data, there's actually a lot. The thing is, when people often say that, they haven't really spent the effort to look into available literatures. So it's not scientific based or founded. But of course, you know, I think what science can help is maybe refine it better.
It had been a while since I used TCM, so I wanted to speak with someone who had recently used TCM and Western medicine and hear about their experience. My brother, Tobin, had recently been diagnosed with functional dyspepsia, a digestive condition. It causes symptoms like bloating, stomach pain, and nausea. His case was due to overactive nerve cells in his stomach, which would fire constantly. To remedy this, he tried using both TCM and Western medicine.
So I have a thing called functional dyspepsia. throughout the last 2 years, we've been just looking at normal medicine, but it wasn't really working. So my mom decided that she wanted to put me on traditional Chinese medicine. So we went to the Chinese medicine store and they had this lady try to analyze me. She was pretty much repeating what I told her through reading my pulse, and I was not really convinced. But anyways, she prescribed me like mosses, trees, and some seashells and stuff to remedy my stomach.
These ingredients were made into a soup, which is a common way to intake herbs or medicine in TCM.
And pretty much after I took it, it was probably the worst it had been in a year and a half. It was just like a lot of bloating and a lot of sharp pain. I think it was just too much for my stomach to handle to be putting all these things that are pretty much indigestible. I don't think it's terrible, and I think certain elements of it are good and certain elements of it are bad. Like, there probably is some active ingredients, but there's just kind of all this pseudoscience going in before it makes it hard to believe that it works.
After this incident, Toma went and saw a gastroenterologist, or digestion specialist, and finally got the medication that helped his condition. Much like my brother, I have concerns about the validity and evidence behind TCM. I brought them up with Dr. Timothy Kam, a family physician who has been practicing Western medicine for over 20 years. With his medical knowledge and experience, I hoped to see if my concerns of TCM were valid and to hear what he had to say about them. Do you have experience using traditional Chinese medicine or practicing it?
No, I don't use it myself. Even if the patient brought in the Chinese medicine's prescription or actual medicine in front of me, I cannot tell them what it is. Chinese medicine, we have not have a single lecture in it. Herbal medicine, we does not have even have one lecture on it. Not saying that it is good or bad. I do not know what they do. That's why I cannot recommend.
If you're unsure if it's good or bad, then why would you support Western medicine over it?
Western medicine practice on evidence-based medicine. So we prescribe a certain medicine because that Western medicine has undergone some research study for many years, animal study, human study. We know exactly what it does. We know the side effect profile and we recommend. Chinese medicine, from my limited understanding, is from traditional Chinese, many years of experience. So they most likely come from quote-unquote experience. Because the ancestor used this combination of medicine to treat this condition and most people get well, this will be the medicine to pick to treat this condition. So it's quite different than the Western scientific.
TCM practitioners I've spoke to say that there's a lack of scientific evidence because the research would be too difficult. What are your thoughts about that claim?
I agree that there will be too much work for them to do scientific research. And with this Chinese medicine that has 8 ingredients, that means you need 8 studies to look at each individual product to see what they will do. And then after doing that, you still need to put them together and see if they do any good. And in fact, nobody will pay for those research. Thinking about all those complicated things, I don't think it will happen. I think Chinese medicine will just remain. You believe in the tradition of Chinese medicine, then take it. I think that it will just remain like that.
Is that lack of evidence concerning for you?
Not really a concern. If they take it, it worked for them, good for them.
It also seems that a lot of the controversy surrounding TCM is when people use it in place of Western medicine. Is there any time you think only Western medicine should be used?
You have an acute illness, you take Western medicine, it kicks in faster, and then you get over it. Chinese medicine is more about it keep the body healthy in the long-term way. That's how people do it. That's what I know. Is it correct or not? I don't have scientific proof of that. By all means, if my patient come in, I try to treat them with my Western medicine. If it fail and I don't have anything better to offer, they are free to select alternative medicine, Chinese or naturopathic or whatnot, to help themselves. Because the bottom line is they want to get better. If Western medicine fail them, they are free to do whatever that make them well.
My entire life, I've been told by family members that traditional Chinese medicine works, and not to doubt it. When I asked my mom questions about it, she never really had an answer. Meeting with a TCM practitioner really helped to clear up some of those questions, and after hearing from professionals in both fields of medicine, I think my opinion on traditional Chinese medicine has actually changed. Although I still don't believe in the methodology of traditional Chinese medicine, like the yin and yang and five elements philosophies, which I still think is a bit far-fetched. I'm not as concerned about the lack of scientific evidence as I was before. Beginning this project, I didn't even consider that the lack of evidence might not be because there is no evidence or that it doesn't actually work, but because finding this evidence is extremely difficult. And if the treatment is working, who am I to say it's not legitimate just because there isn't scientific evidence to back it up? There's probably a reason why TCM has been practiced for so long and the popularity is still growing. I don't think they've just been lucky for the past 2,500 years. I still believe that Western medicine should be prioritized when seeking treatment for any medical condition or illness, especially in emergencies. But like Dr. Kam said, if you haven't found the results you're looking for from Western medicine, then maybe traditional Chinese medicine can help.
Listening to student-created stories produced for LFS 400, an audio storytelling class in the Faculty of Land and Food Systems here at UBC. For more information on LFS 400 and to hear more stories, visit lfs400.landfood.ubc.ca. Thanks so much for listening.